Does hands up here who's ever met David? Oh my gosh, look! Isn't that nice? Should we just give him and his family a round of applause for being great? So firstly, the aim of this is to support David and Good Faith Partnership and Joseph Davies and all the others collaborating in changing the needle in critical issues of our day, which is really exciting. But it's also about inspiring anyone who's under 18 to kind of think through how can we make decisions now to kind of become the kind of people that when we get to David's age can be doing the kind of things he's doing. So fulfilling our original design. So I'm going to have a session. I'm going to do a Q&A with David now. But I want anyone who's under 18 to be thinking of a question you could ask him in a few minutes about anything that's come up or anything about how his personality or some decisions he made in his life or his faith has helped inform the kind of work he's doing now. So firstly, I'm going to ask David to tell us a story, as ever, because it really goes to the heart of the pain of human things. It's going to be a little bit of a tearjerker, possibly, as well as as hope. We're going to come through to hope. Thanks, David.
That's all right. Gosh, that's quite a setup, isn't it? Hi, everyone. Great to see you. So a few years ago, I got a bit of a dream career opportunity, a project to work really closely with the mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, and to particularly work on issues related to refugees and asylum seekers in Bristol. And it was a bit of a God thing, the whole thing, really, because we were just in the process of moving to Bristol. And it was a brilliant role in lots of ways, but it had some quite hard bits at times. And in particular, one of the hardest bits was trying to be part of conversations and relate to the Home Office, national government, and to a company called Clear Springs Ready Homes, who manage accommodation for asylum seekers on behalf of the government. They have a contract with the government to run that. And they don't really do a very good job of that. The system kind of started going a bit wrong. They ran out of accommodation. They started having to use hotels a few years ago. And then COVID happened, and lockdown happened. And I had to sit in these online meetings talking about the situation for asylum seekers in hotels in Bristol, which was really grim, because if you're an asylum seeker in the UK, you get given £8 a week. You get, obviously, some accommodation. You get pretty poor quality food in the hotel. You can't cook food for yourself. And then you've got £8. You're not allowed to work. You're not allowed to study. It's terrible. And you have no idea what's happening to you or your family. You often are in limbo for a long period of time. So people would be catching COVID in the hotels, and it was really horrible. And then it got a bit worse because the Home Office decided to close down one of the hotels, but they didn't do a very good job. So they didn't really tell people in the hotel what was happening or where they were going to be going. It was total chaos. And I remember when they shut down the hotel, I was having conversations with people working for different charities, and they were saying people are getting basically put in taxis and they don't really know where they're going. And then they're getting phone calls from people in Cardiff and in other places saying, like, we don't know anyone here. And it was really horrible. And then I'd been in these meetings trying to say, we need a better plan here. We need to do something different, but it hadn't really worked. And then what was even worse was a couple of weeks later, the Home Office turned around and said, oh, we've decided actually we do need that hotel. So we're going to use it again, but put different people in there. So it was just a really horrible situation. Oh. But there wasn't much I could do. And I was like, what am I even doing? I feel like I'm doing nothing in these meetings. I can't really affect change. But then a couple of years later, the war in Ukraine started, and we had this big issue in Bristol that people were about to arrive in Ukraine. They were going to live in people's homes, but there was no system to support them when they arrived. And so we had this opportunity to work with the churches to set up what are called welcome hubs. And you may know about them because we have one here on a Thursday evening that Joe Davies runs. And we were able to set up a network of these different welcome hubs across the city. But our dream for these was not just to support Ukrainians, but also to support other refugees and asylum seekers in the city. And over a long period of time, and particularly through the hard work of Joe, who's been really at the front line of this, we've been able to do that. And some of those welcome hubs have started really connecting with people who are still in those hotels in Bristol to this day. And the other week, we got a chance to invite people from the Home Office to come to Bristol and to see what was happening with the welcome hubs. And so last Monday, I was in one of the welcome hubs at St. Mary Redcliffe, which is next to, there's a big hotel next to there. It's got hundreds of asylum seekers living there. And because the church has been offering their space and they've got a great kitchen there. And so when we went there, there were people from the hotel in the kitchen cooking food for themselves and letting their kids run around and generally having a great time. So it's for me, when I kind of look back and think, what was that time in COVID was, I mean, it was hard for everyone, wasn't it? But for that bit, for me personally, was so difficult, feeling so powerless. But recognizing that I guess maybe God was putting something, breaking my heart for that situation, for those people. And I couldn't do anything in that moment, but over time, the opportunities arose. And I didn't let go of that. And I thought, we have to try and do something for those people. And by God's mercy, we've been able to.
Thank you, David. So if you had to sum up in like a sentence, what do you think the problem is?
The problem is that it's about how politics works in this country, and that there are politicians and political parties that think they can win more votes by casting a group of people as the other and as a threat, when in reality they are human beings that are trying to do the best for them and their family in very difficult circumstances. And so when you have that kind of political narrative that says these people are other, they are a threat, then that justifies, you create a system that treats them not really as human beings. And so the way people in that hotel were being treated, that was the thing that just got me inside, was they are not being treated with the dignity and the respect that all human beings deserve. That's the fundamental problem.
Yeah, thank you. While I'm asking the next question, can someone just Google sheep of the goats parable, and whoever does it gets to come up and just read the bit of it. I'm going to ask you to read that in a minute. So that's the problem. What do you think a solution is that God has put on your heart to help can be bring a creative solution to this problem?
So I think ultimately the solution is to treat people like people and to find ways to do that. And this is why I love working with churches, but also connected to politics, because the church is uniquely placed to treat people as people. And that's what happens in the welcome hubs. They're not a complex, you know, social intervention. They are people treating other human beings as human beings. And the impact of that, particularly for those people that don't always get treated like that, is extraordinary. But it was particularly nice to be able to show the Home Office people what was happening and to work with the council and others, because it was a way of trying to say, hey, you can do things differently. Like, the system doesn't have to be brutal and inhumane. There are ways of and actually, isn't this better for everybody? Because if we have people that aren't, you know, desperately struggling with their mental health and unable to work and unable to contribute, like, wouldn't we all be better off if we treated people like people? So I think having the chance to try and do that at both a very kind of human scale, but also then trying to find ways to build that in. I mean, the big challenge for us now is, if there is a new government, you know, how can we advocate to say this is what the system should now look like? So it's not just the church off on its own doing something differently, it's actually continually saying to society and to politicians, let's have a better system.
Thank you. How did the Home Office hear about the the kind of how it was happening in Bristol that was working and was treating people with dignity?
That's a good question. How did they hear about it? I think through relationships, ultimately. And this was a tricky thing, was that when I was in those meetings about the hotels, like I've rarely felt more angry in a kind of professional context. But you know, there's no use in just shouting and screaming at people and kind of breaking those relationships. I would have been fully justified in having a big old rant at them, and I probably had the opportunity to. And so trying to find the right tone of conveying genuine anger, but also not totally ruining and breaking those relationships. And recognizing that even within somewhere like the Home Office, it's very easy to kind of demonize the whole, a whole group and say a Home Office, government, bad. But in reality, those people that we invited to Bristol, that, one of them used to work for Fair Trade, and has worked in the charity sector. Like they're good people. They're in a bad system, and they're in a bad bit of this, particularly bad bit of the system. And so we continually, and Joe as well does a really good job of continually building relationships with people, even when they're not the obvious people to be trying to build a relationship with.
That's brilliant. One of the things we absolutely love here is the 24-hour prayer movement, don't we? That happened from the... Has anyone heard of the Moravians? They started to build a 24/7 prayer non-stop for 100 years, and that was seen as the kind of trigger of the Protestant missionary movement. But what we forget was they were refugees and asylum seekers. We decorate the tombs of the righteous. We love it in the past. But Count Zinzendorf welcomed them into his home, his actual home and land, and set up an entire village where they could pray. The nature of people who come from other places are they are other. They have a different language, different culture, different values, even if they may even have the same Christian belief, but it might even be expressed in a different way, or they may have a different belief. And so this is now. I don't want us to be a church that decorates the tomb of the righteous, but doesn't see the now. And it's about literally what David's saying, the person in front of us, literally that person in front of us, whoever it is, treating them with dignity and humanity. As we, exactly what we're doing in the Sermon on the Mount, I'm going to be speaking into the next one, is agape love, love your enemies. The three words that will literally, if everyone put it into practice, literally change the world. I cannot think of a single problem that wouldn't be solved if those three words weren't put into practice. So I know that I'm preaching to the converted, we both are, but I think this is an absolutely critical moment in our cultural moment as Christians. And what I love about what David said is he managed to steward the protest into change. Can you feel that? Can you feel how he stewarded the protest into actual change rather than stopped with the protest? It is a real failure if we stop with protest, because what we don't want is protest. We want change. We want people to actually just be treated with dignity. That's the end goal. So we need the wisdom and the shrewdness and everything to move there. Had anyone found the sheep and the goats? Brilliant. Bex, if you can come up, I'll ask you what verse is. So what we are, I'm going to ask David one more question. Then I want the under-18s to ask him a question. Please just go for it. Just, most of us know each other quite well here. This is an amazing opportunity. One more question I'm going to ask David. In the light of all of that, who are the surprising people that God has asked you, or you felt you've been able to collaborate with in your work, who literally you found it quite a surprising partnership?
So the strapline of the Good Faith Partnership is building a better world through the power of unlikely relationships. And so that's kind of, everything we do is trying to build, the broadest possible coalition of people involved. It will be a very unlikely partnership if we end up working with the Home Office to scale up and to roll out this Welcome Hub model, which is what we're talking to them about now. That would be really exciting if we were able to do that, and to go from being adversaries in that situation to being able to actually work in partnership. So we will see.
Okay, this is in the Message version. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me."
So essentially exactly what David's saying, our theology is everyone is created in the image of God. In a world that believes we're chemical accidents kept alive by a dying star, of course you don't treat the person in front of you with dignity, however much cognitive dissonance you have. If you're trained ideologically in that cruel way of thinking about the other, what are you going to do when you're faced with the other, particularly if the other is inconvenient? But if we are trained in the theology, the very first page of the Hebrew Bible, this ancient text that we're still living into the reality today, that every human, male and female, is made in the image of God. It was radical then. Only one human was made in the image of God in other creation Near Eastern narratives. That was the king. No one else was. Everyone was made to be slaves to the gods. So everyone was made in the image of God. If that is what we live into, we have the incredible privilege, freedom, joy, and liberation of treating the other with dignity. We can just do that. We can be free from our fears, free from our reasons, free from our self-justifications to just treat the other with dignity. That's all we need to do. God will work out all the things that need to be worked out. All he's saying is that person in front of you, if you love them, you're loving me. It's really simple. And I don't want us to be a church that does a lot of little theological leaps not to just obey that. Literally, that simple thing, the person, the way we treat that person in front of us is the way we treat Jesus. It's not different. We can worship him. But if we're not treating that person with dignity, there's a dissonance that lacks what we call integration or integrity. We are not integrated Christians if we love Jesus but cannot treat the person with dignity. And I think that's what God is, you know, God and David himself is that's what's going on here. But what is exciting is God is using David and Joe and other people to just turn the needle in what could now happen in the way we treat refugees and asylum seekers in this country. Can you feel that? Can you feel the adventure and the exhilaration once we just make that decision to treat someone with dignity? We have all of heaven behind us because that's reality. So anyone under the age of 18 want to ask any questions about David? Because you don't just turn up one day and the Home Office comes and asks you a question about how you're treating refugees and asylum seekers. There is a big backstory to that. So if anyone has got a question, yes, Jemima.
When and how did you kind of get called to this? Like, was it specifically this thing? And was it kind of like a feeling, or did someone tell you, or what happened?
Great question. I've never been someone who has had like one very specific kind of cause, as it were, that I felt like this is my life's work to work solely on that cause. So I've always been interested in issues around refugees, for example. But if you'd asked me 10 years ago, you know, is that the thing? I probably would have said, I don't know. And I've worked on other things in the past, other social justice issues. And I found that I'm actually able to get equally passionate about lots of different things. I think that's different for different people. There are some people there where it's very specific, and there's some people for whom it's a bit broader. I was thinking, when I was a teenager, we used to my dinner table was a bit unusual because we'd talk about all the things you're not supposed to talk about, politics and religion. My dad's an academic theologian, so that kind of helped. But we used to talk about those things, and I was fascinated by, like, how does the world actually work? There's some people that are fascinated by how physical things work, right, like cars and planes and all that stuff. That's never been my thing. I've always been interested, how does society work? Who has power? How do decisions get made? Why do some people win in that process and some people lose? And so that was the thing that I kind of pursued. I studied history at university. I got involved in student politics. We ended up being a student union president. And then I just met really interesting people, and I followed the opportunities that came up on a kind of step-by-step basis, really. So my career was never a particularly, like, planned thing. It was always, what am I interested in? What am I passionate about? Put myself out there when I saw opportunities. And then I just found opportunities follow opportunities, really. You do one thing well, someone notices. They give you another opportunity to do something else. And that's how my journey has progressed, really.
That's great. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm going to push the bat on. I want three questions from young people. Have you got another question? Love it.
Were there any, like, specific qualifications that you got that kind of helped with that? So, like, a degree or is it just, like, your personality or... what sort of stuff helps?
It's almost like I've set Jemima up, but I haven't, honestly. Perfect question.
So I did get a degree, and that was definitely helpful. I studied at Oxford University, and again, just being realistic, that was helpful in terms of what I've gone on to do, because that has a certain prestige about it in terms of a kind of a name, an institution. I'm not sure that's a brilliant thing, by the way, but that's the reality. I think what that degree gave me was, you know, the brand, the name, whatever, but also the actual process of, in my degree, we did tutorials. So you'd have like a week to study a particular topic, you'd write an essay, and then at the end of that week, you'd have to argue your essay in front of, like, maybe one other student and a tutor, and the tutor probably wrote half of the books that you were reading to write your essay. So it's quite an intense experience, and my wife Hannah often jokes that my main professional skill is blagging, which is definitely true. So, like, I can talk quite confidently about things that I don't actually know a huge amount about. That is what an Oxbridge education gives you, for better or for worse. So I think, but then I do, you know, I've worked with people from all different kinds of backgrounds. I think people that, the older I get, the more I think it, self-knowledge is the key, I think. If you know yourself, if you know what you are passionate about and you know what you are really good at and what you're particularly gifted in, then you'll be pretty unstoppable, like, regardless of what, like, qualifications or whatever you have, because it's really clear when someone is passionate about something and they know what they're about, and that is useful in a way that someone who doesn't really know what they're about can be quite hard for them to navigate the world, I think. So don't get obsessed with the credentials, the degree, know yourself, and then see where that journey takes you.
Yeah, any other questions? Oh, Emma. Let's make a theology really quickly that says you're sort of somehow immortal and therefore you're young. You're a child in the kingdom. Do you like what I did there? Blagging.
You've kind of briefly mentioned your faith, but I'd be interested, how's that influenced where you've got today? How does that work, your relationship with God? Is it anything to do with your work? Has it developed? You know, do you... yeah, what does it look like?
The other thing is, if anyone's got any questions, they don't want to say it to the microphone, they can write it down on a piece of paper here and give it to me. So I'm so sorry, I always forget to say that.
Yeah, it's almost like it's hard to pick out what's the kind of component of faith, as if it was like different ingredients that then you kind of throw into the mix, and then because it's all interwoven for me, it's all kind of one thing rather than being different things. Like my faith is partly the story of my family, my ancestors, who were involved in this kind of work in the world over many generations. It's partly that worldview. Like, why do I think that people should be treated as people is related to my faith, obviously. And why do I get that feeling inside where I don't see that happening, that kind of slightly, you know, that kind of holy anger, as it were. I think that's connected to faith. But then also the actual jobs that I've tended to do have almost always involved some relationship with the church as well. Because I think the church is quite a unique kind of force in society. And so being part of that kind of Christian community. I've also, by the way, found the church to be an exceptionally useful social network for career progression and for finding colleagues. The number of people that I've recruited from Hope Church in and of itself is quite striking. I don't think that's an accident either, actually, because what I've discovered is when you meet other Christians in a professional context, you already have that kind of basis of trust that can take a long time to build in other relationships, because you kind of, I mean, you know, Christians are not all the same, but once you get to know people, there's a kind of common set of values, common set of beliefs, that then you can be like, okay, we can work together, whether that's in the same organization or different organizations. So I think my faith has kind of played a part in lots of different aspects of my career.
Any more questions? And we're just breaking through, aren't we, now to adults? You're a child in the kingdom as well, Jane.
David, I was really interested when you said, you know, they had that horrendous time when you felt very powerless. And then I'm really interested how you talk about that holy anger. And then you talk about meetings with politicians and, you know, good people. But then that struggle with anger, I'm really interested in that.
Yeah, great. So we've had one. This is going to be the last question for this section, because I want people to come and now pray for David about the Home Office taking on this partnership of Welcome Hubs, whoever ends up in government this year, rolling this out across the nation so that every single asylum seeker and refugee is treated with dignity. That is what we're going to be praying for in a minute. So I think this is a really key question, because we see a lot of anger that actually doesn't bring change. What we want is change. And David is showing us how you can have anger against injustice, which is God. He is angry about injustice, but he did what he needed to do to deliver change to the human condition. He moved through it into a solution. The full bodily death of all sin, evil, injustice, and systemic violence within himself on the cross. That is the gospel. He dealt with it in the most agape love, problem-solving way. And then when he was physically raised from the dead, he opens that up for us so we don't have to end with that powerless anger feeling. It, through him, we can get to a place of collaboration and change, where we genuinely partner with him for change. So this is a really critical question for our day, because I think people often get stuck in the anger. And it says in James, as some of you are doing in Bible Book Club, unrighteous anger doesn't lead to the way of God. There are two kinds of anger, there's righteous and unrighteous. So what David's going to be talking about or answering is how he managed to steward that well to a change that is now potentially life-giving for this whole country.
When I was a student, I came across something called community organizing. And at the time, it was quite sexy because it was what Barack Obama did before he was a lawyer. And I did a kind of summer internship and learned all about it. It's a really interesting methodology for how to make change. in the world, and it started in America, and there are lots of faith groups and churches in America that are involved, but also in the UK. There's a group called Citizens UK who do it in the UK, and there might in fact be a bit of a Bristol expression of it coming, which is exciting. But in the training that they do, one of the things they talk about is the concept of, they talk about anger, they talk about the concept of cold anger. So it's basically saying anger is in and of itself not a bad thing, but that kind of like hot anger, that like rage, is not very constructive. But the thing that we should be cultivating is this idea of cold anger, which is to not let go of the things that are kind of making us angry, but to kind of, as you say, to kind of try and channel that into useful kind of ways. And I think one of the key things around that is how do you build kind of collective anger, as it were? How do you find other people who feel that same way? Because one angry person is not likely to be hugely impactful. But lots and lots and lots of angry people who are organized and who have that kind of sense of cold anger can make an enormous amount of difference. In fact, that's probably the biggest force for change in the world, I would suggest. So, yeah, I think that it starts in us, in how we hold that kind of anger. But then I think that crucial next step as well is like, who else is feeling this? And if I hadn't found other people like Claire Fenner-Crawley, who used to be part of this church, she worked with me really closely on the Welcome Hubs. If I hadn't found Joe, who's been, you know, running this one and setting up loads of other ones, if it wasn't for the churches, like, you know, my part in what the story of what's happened is a very limited one. It needed lots of other people in the council, elsewhere, to feel that same sense of, this is rubbish, let's do something better than this.
Thank you so much. And I have to say, to honour David, he was repeatedly wanting me to have Joseph Davies here, so because Joseph is the one, as anyone who knows he's met him, is just burns for this issue. Like, we're talking about, he's like a multiple cause. David's like one of those, and Joseph's like single cause. So you meet him, you meet God's heart for refugees and asylum seekers. It's like embodied. And so he really wanted Joseph to be here as well today, but Joseph couldn't make it. So I just want to honour David in that. He releases people into the thing they're designed to do. So when he says, oh, I care about a lot of things, what he's really doing is saying he has that capacity to cover a lot of issues around bringing justice where there's injustice. So we are now going to, is there any other questions from under 18s? Any older people can ask David whenever they like. Just saying, you know, we're a community here. Right, we are now going to pray for David, and we're going to pray for this one thing, that the Home Office, whoever is in government this year, takes on board the idea of welcome hubs across the country as a dignified way of treating anyone who's a refugee or an asylum seeker to this country in such a way that leads to human flourishing. Because we're designed to embody and show the world the sheep and the goats reality about how life actually is. I'd love some people to come up to the front and lay hands on David. Are you okay with that? Yeah. And then any prophetic words as well that people have. This is live. Before this, things are as they are. And after this, things change. That's the authority and the agency we have. That's why we meet. We don't meet to tick the box of feeling good about meeting. We meet for transactional change on issues we think the Spirit's leading us into. Great. I'll start, and then anyone can take the microphone.